Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking. Josephine, Napoleon's wife. What do you think when you hear that name? Maybe the famous quote, or that she became an empress? The real Josephine was all this and more. She was a widow, a single mother. She spent some time in prison. She had affairs, had a serious shopping addiction, very bad teeth, was a horticulturalist, an art collector. She imported wild animals from around the globe. She set fashions, spoke in a low, sexy voice, and was a superb hostess and a charming diplomat. I'm very excited today to be interviewing the author of Josephine, Desire, Ambition, Napoleon by Kate Williams, who adores the 18th century. She went to Oxford and has tons of degrees. She lectures on history and appears regularly on TV. Kate, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thrilled to be here, and I'm sure Josephine will be delighted to be looking down and watching us in a gorgeous radio.
So Josephine grew up in a backwater, Martinique, the Caribbean. Can you tell us about her childhood?
Well, that was a very arduous research trip, of course, for me to have to go to Martinique, which was fabulous, fabulous, beautiful. And she lived in Martinique, this slave-owning island, and she was on a very small plantation, a very poor plantation, and that was partly because her father was a terrible plantation owner. He was a very bad manager, and he was really disappointed in the fact he had three daughters, Josephine and her two younger sisters. That was a massive disappointment to him. And when there was a huge hurricane when she was only a small child, he never rebuilt it. It never made any money. So they were pretty much an impoverished family. She was very pretty, very appealing. But who'd marry a girl with no money?
So she was slightly on her uppers then. Were her family grand in any way, though?
Her family had a grand ancestry. They had a very aristocratic French ancestry. But it all crumbled to nothing by the time Josephine was growing up. The father was so unenamoured of being with them, he spent his entire time having fun in the city, in the capital, with courtesans, with gambling. And pretty much Josephine's mother and her elderly father were trying to piece together the plantation when he wasn't there.
So she saw a strong mother and a weak father then, didn't
she? Strong mother, weak father.
Yeah. Did they have any ambitions for her?
The ambitions for Josephine were really that she'd make a very good marriage. That's all you bred girls for. That's why they were so pointless. They just had to get married. So her ideal husband would have been someone who's going to inherit a big plantation himself, and then she would have just brought up lots of children and managed the household. But you need to have some money to attract that kind of man, and she really had nothing. She finished school at just a teenager, just short of 15, and came home just to lie around in the sun. That's all she did because there were no real suitors. Josephine's life was very carefree, right from a child. She was running around, sucking on sugarcane, and that's why she had those really, really bad teeth.
Yeah, someone described her teeth as looking like cloves, so you can imagine them
not
just little
very
black
appealing
stuff.
Then yeah, they got worse and worse with age. They weren't quite that bad in her early teenage years, but by her 30s they were really bad, so she used to laugh with a handkerchief over her mouth so no one would see her awful teeth.
I bet that became a fashion then. You
it became a fashion. Yeah. And she always smiled with a very enigmatic, closed smile. Like that. So no one would see those big, big holes in her teeth. And they gave her tremendous pain. They gave her a lot of pain. But, you know, she just kept eating sweets. She couldn't stop. She was an addict. And first of all, she ate a lot of sweets because she was in Martinique. She ran wild. Then when she got to France, eating sweets was the indicator of riches because that's what only the rich could afford because sugar was so expensive. So the richer the lady, the more sugar you ate. I mean, our rich ladies now would be in horror of that. Yeah, it's kind of the opposite. The richer the lady, the more sugar you ate. So she ate sugar like all the other posh girls, and her teeth were a wreck.
So she was desperate to leave the island. How did she manage it?
Josephine was desperate to escape Martinique. She had these visions of Paris. Her father filled her head with ideas of Versailles, with ideas of beauty. Very exciting stuff. But how could you get out with no money? That's the question. But then something really lucky happened. Her aunt, her father's sister, was carrying on a very, very bad, dubious affair with the ex-governor of the island. He'd gone back to France. She'd followed him, moved in with him. And she wanted to kind of cement her ties with him much more because, well, he still had a wife. And his son, what she wanted to do was marry him to one of her nieces and make sure that they were together forever, as it were, bound through marriage. That's how people in the 18th century created bonds. So she's Alexandre de Beauharnais, very handsome young man, 17. He's kind of a hero, just out of Dangerous Liaisons, very chiseled-jawed and steely blue eyes and all the rest of it. The perfect fantasy if you're a teenage girl. The aunt said to him, would you marry one of those girls? Because they had enough money for all of them, didn't need a dowry. He said, oh, okay, but not the oldest. She's far too old at 15, far too old. She's set in her ways. So I want the younger one, the younger one. He wanted the younger one who was 13, but then she died. He tried for the younger one who was 11, and the mother said no. So in the end, he had to put up with a really elderly, over-the-hill 15-year-old.
And so she was packed off to France, but she arrived, and he was not a disappointment to her, but he just looked at her and thought,
El horreur. El horreur, absolument. Oh no, no, no. That's what he thought.
Basically, why? What was wrong with her?
Well, she thought he was fabulous, but oh no, what a sight. Because in France, they really romanticise the Creole glamorous girl. Beautiful and sexy and had all those secret tricks, as well as being a little bit husky. Mm-hmm. But Josephine wasn't like that at all. She was a plump girl dressed in nothing resembling the latest fashions. She was rather gauche, had terrible teeth, had really bad hairstyle. Everything about her was just...
She had a bad accent.
Bad accent, very thick accent. You could cut it with a knife. It was all very unformed schoolgirl. Nothing glamorous whatsoever. Alexandre was horrified. The problem was he was rather spoiled because he'd already had some very glamorous, much older, married mistresses who'd taught him in the ways of sophistication. So this innocent child was just simply a turn-off.
So what he did was he ran back into the arms of his mistress, didn't he?
He ran to the arms of his mistress, Laure de Longpré, a very sexy married lady. Man back to her, said, oh God, quelle horreur, I've got to marry this ingenue, no, no, no. And just spent his whole time romancing her, and how marvellous that was. Josephine was left on her own. He married her, he went through with what he was supposed to do, but she was left on her own in their chilly house in Paris. And every time she saw him, he just complained about her dress, her speech, her lack of education, her lack of glamour. It wasn't a very happy start.
So her self-esteem must have really plummeted.
Her self-esteem did plummet, but she was so thrilled to be in France. At least she was away from Martinique. And he did sometimes take her to salons, and that was an insight into a glamorous world. And she gradually began to learn how to really dress in the right way, to speak in the right way. And then she fell pregnant. She fell pregnant very quickly with his first child and then his second child. And he was really delighted by the children, would never be delighted by her, but was thrilled to have a son, a legitimate one. Yeah. He had some non-legitimate ones, was thrilled to have a legitimate child. And, you know, he really kept up the idea of the happy family until, that is, he went off to Martinique on an investigatory mission. Got this passion there that Josephine had loads of affairs and loads of men and been wild and, you know, had non-stop dodgy one-night stands, and decided when he got back that he wasn't going to see her at all. He was furious. He decided that was it. And she, essentially, he got back and he sent his mistress, Laure de Longpré, to say to her, you're dumped. So Laure de Longpré came in and said, I'm sorry, my dear, you are kaput, that's the end of you. Pure triumph. And Josephine was abandoned, not even 21, with two small children. What was she going to do? He said to her, well, I'm not going to marry you. I'm not going to stay with you anymore. I've got to get rid of you. Either you go home to Martinique or you live in a convent. And so she said, okay, I'll go and live in a convent. I don't want to go back home because I'll never come back. So it was rather fun because convents in those days were full of There were nuns there, but they were generally full of abandoned women, abandoned wives that men had got bored of, abandoned daughters that couldn't find husbands. So it was kind of like this big, rather gossip girl school. It was full of gossip girls. Yeah. It was a harem. Yeah. And Josephine arrived there, and the convent really became the transformation of her. She learned from all these abandoned wives who couldn't wait just to teach her, who were a bit like the mean girls. These mean girls, they taught her about dress, about makeup, about carriage, about what to say. And she learned all these invaluable skills, most of all about makeup, because that's a very important one, for which was valuable in grabbing Napoleon. In those days, it was rather bizarre. We would be a bit shocked by their makeup now. So no nail varnish, because they didn't have the chemicals for that. No eyeshadow, really. What they used to do was make their skin bright white, so they got lead and painted it all over their face. Really horrible bright white lead paint, which of course is going to give you nice big holes. It could decay it. And then a little bit of coal on your eyebrows. You should shave your eyebrows off and replace them with mouse hair. But what you really... nice.
What, kind of thin then?
Yes, you've got the mouse skin. Cut out a piece of mouse skin. Put it over your eyebrow.
Fabulous.
And then what you really wanted most of all was the rouge. So pale white face and then big, big blobs of rouge. And the bigger the blob, the more open you were for, well, naughtiness. So a genteel married lady would wear a very small blob, and a lady on the brink of something else wear a big blob. So rouge was really vital, and she hadn't understood rouge before. So these ladies said to her, first thing you've got to do, lady, is put big blobs of rouge on your face. So she did.
What was the rouge made of?
It was made of all kinds of dodgy chemicals, cochineal,
yes,
all kinds of
beetles,
stuff. Crushed
it?
Beetles. Mm. But at least, crushed beetles, not very good, but at least it wasn't going to rot your skin like the lead. So actually, rouge was quite a healthy kind of thing to be wearing on their skin.
Did they wear any lipstick or not?
No, not really. Lipstick, not really. Eyeshadow, not really. Just a little bit of coal. But it's very interesting that it wasn't, in those days, it wasn't just for courtesans. By the Victorian era, makeup was just for the bad girl.
Yeah.
In that era, even the good girls, even the married ladies of six, they would all wear rouge. They would wear just a tinsy bit less. And, you know, the rouge manufacturers, well, they charged an absolute fortune. You could spend thousands a year just on this stuff. And a lot of people got very rich out of the rouge fashion.
I love it.
RadioGorgeous.com.
What happened was that she decided to really become a high-class courtesan. She thought, I want to get in with the right people.
Well, poor Josephine didn't really have much choice. Essentially, she was this woman. She had a husband, but he wasn't going to live with her. She couldn't marry anyone else because she was still attached. You can't get a divorce. Mm. So she was really very stuck. What can she do? She has no family. So the only answer really is to live as a kept woman. There was no way she could work. I mean, even if she had been able to have a job, she wasn't the job-getting type.
No,
not really. wasn't the best, perhaps the sharpest of knives at exams. So essentially, she had to really live off the favours of men. And what she did start doing was live off the favours of men outside the court. And, you know, she was actually a very rare commodity, because most women of her age, most young women in their early 20s, they were under the protection of their father, who was eagle-eyed about his precious daughter, or under the protection of her husband, who wouldn't let anyone close to them. And men didn't necessarily want courtesans, because they wanted a lady they could take out respectable,
lady, yeah,
in a respectable fashion to salons as a friend,
yeah,
who wasn't a courtesan.
Yeah.
But they couldn't take a married girl, they couldn't take a single girl, because her father would go bonkers. So Josephine actually fitted that part. There were many other women who were looking, who were spare, but they were much older. So to get a young, free woman, free of a father and a husband, what a prize. She's also pretty and got massive blobs of rouge on her face. I mean, what a prize. So she could get any man she wanted. They flocked around her, and she really started to be on the outskirts of the court of the king and Marie Antoinette in Versailles, in Fontainebleau, where they hunted. And she befriended the head of the hunt so much that he said, you can follow the hunt at a distance. So pretty fabulous.
So she was socially ambitious.
She was very socially ambitious. And I think she was also trying to take a bit of revenge on her husband. Well, Alexandre, you didn't want me, but just look at the Marquis of Blur-Blur and the Count of Wawa, who are desperately in love with me, and I'm not being brought down by you. And of course, he was terribly annoyed by it. And he was terribly annoyed that the actual authorities had said, you don't have any right to keep this woman imprisoned because she is blameless. He was really annoyed.
Yes, we were going to go on to that. So then the revolution happened and all her friends started being imprisoned.
Yes. That was slightly before, but
okay,
yes, but you don't have any right to keep her in the convent. You have to let her out.
The convent,
yes, the government said you don't have any right to keep her in the convent. Let her out. So she had fun.
Oh, really? So he made her go in the convent?
He made her go in the convent, and the government said, you have no right to keep her there because she is blameless. You were the one essentially having affairs, so she can come out. So the government said she can come out and live on her own, although how on earth she was going to live. And that's why she became this rather glamorous rather glamorous girl about town on the outskirts of the hunt. So it was, she really pieced together a rather successful life for herself. She was gaining money, she was gaining favour, she was doing really well. And then, as you say, the revolution struck.
And then everyone started going to prison. Their life literally collapsed, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, Josephine had amazing timing. She was actually in Martinique paying a visit on her family when the revolution struck, and that's probably because she was massively in debt and she was escaping a bit of a sticky situation at Versailles. But she came back from Martinique and France was completely changed. Of course, they didn't know. The post hadn't got to them. France was completely changed. You know, everything was different. The place was a wreck. The cap of liberty was around. And her friends were in prison. It was terrifying. Initially, it looked to be something that she would do rather well out of it, because Alexandre, her estranged husband, he became rather successful in the new administration and rather popular. And when the king and queen, when Marie Antoinette and the king tried to escape from their imprisonment in the Tuileries and tried to run away in that famous, famous scene where they all dress up as servants and bundle themselves into a big carriage and hide away and just get caught, well, he actually got them back and brought them back. So that was vital for him. But also that moment when the royal family failed to escape, that was when the revolution turned tough and turned nasty. After that, it was almost inevitable that they'd be imprisoned, that they'd be executed. And after that, the imprisonment, the execution, which Josephine was horrified by, after that came the terror in which everyone was being imprisoned, the aristocrats. And it didn't matter that Alexandre had been part of the government. He was imprisoned. He was thrown into prison. And Josephine was his estranged wife, and so she was part of him. And she had to be in prison too, so she tried everything. She wrote saying she was a sans-culotte revolutionary, that her son was a revolutionary, her children were... She tried to apprentice her children to tailors and dressmakers. It didn't matter. It really didn't matter. She was dragged into prison. The children were left behind. And she really thought that was it in this awful prison in Paris, and she thought that... that was her done for.
But she even enjoyed herself in the prison. She was, should make the most of things.
Prison. Well, prison, everyone was just like, okay, I'm about to die. Yeah. Let's just go for it. So there was a lot of last minute fun happening in the prison. It was all aristocrats and there was
must have been a laugh, actually.
Well, there was no real reason to put them in kind of solitary confinement the way we put people in prison now, because they were just being grouped together until they got bumped off and executed. So they put them all in big rooms, and they were it's a big converted nunnery, so it wasn't very organised either. And also, if you were pregnant, you would get a release to have the baby. So women were not only having fun to carpe diem, but they also were hoping to get pregnant, and that would be a release for at least a few months, and perhaps they hoped the government might forget about them after that.
Yeah.
So women were, there's a lot of affairs, a lot of wild affairs. Josephine was there with every duchess she'd ever known. And Josephine began to have an affair with one General Hoche, a very aristocratic, handsome man, who also had a rather privileged life in the prison. He had his own special room, nice food, nice drinks. You can imagine every girl is trying to get hold of him so she can have his better food, his better drink, and Josephine succeeds. And they start this rather passionate affair in prison. Alexandra's there, but he's having an affair with someone else, and doesn't matter. And he and Josephine actually become friendly for the sake of their children. And it all is going quite well until Alexandra is dragged off to be executed. He writes Josephine this really touching, really sweet letter saying, you know, for our children, please live, as if he thought she ever would. And then he's executed. And pretty much after that, once he's executed, Josephine's not far off. A woman in the 18th century was just the offshoot of her husband. Whatever he got executed for, she should too. And so she was really due to be executed. And then just before she was, Robespierre, the architect of the terror, there was a massive coup. He was overtaken, he was killed, and she was free. She was almost free almost immediately. So at one minute she was expecting every day to be told, okay, you know, get in the cart, go off to be executed. Next minute she's set free into Paris. Amazing.
So Josephine was now a widower and she'd just been released from prison. What happened next?
Well, suddenly everyone else is released as well. And so she can pretty much go back to her old life if she'd like as a glamorous girl, except no one's got any money, least of all her. And her children, they've just about survived, but they haven't got any money either. So You know, it's life of real poverty. And in those days, there was so little money. There was massive bread riots, and Josephine was so liked in upper society that she was allowed to go to parties without taking her own bread. Because in those days, you had to take your own bread to a party because they hadn't got any. But her life was very difficult. And so she thought, I've got to do a bit of social climbing here. Previously, through her life, Josephine had used men to social climb. Now, this time, she decided, I'm going to use a woman. A woman she befriended in prison, the very beautiful Teresa Cabarrus, who was the lover of the great politician Jean-Lambert Tallien. And she thought, I'm going to have her. This is a very young, you know, early 20s, very beautiful, very glamorous. And Josephine went all out with all her skills of flattery, because Josephine was an incredible flatterer. She went all out with her skills of flattery to flatter Teresa, because she knew that Teresa moved in these great big circles of riches and power, and Josephine wanted to find her next protector in this circle. So it's very clever, I think. It's a very clever way of, you know, you befriend the woman who's part of these circles and you'll get hold of the men. So that's the best way to do it.
And then they became the celebrities, didn't they, of Paris. You know, everybody wrote about them. Everybody talked about them. What were they wearing? I mean, they literally were in the newspapers every day.
Well, Teresa Tallien is this glamorous girl, the politician's young wife. Everyone wrote about her, because we always want to write about glamorous ladies, and most of them had been bumped off by the executioner. So we hadn't really got many left, especially Marie Antoinette was gone, all the other girls were gone. Teresa was one of the few still surviving, and she was a very, very kind of wild girl. She had to do these fabulous parties, and also her dress was unbelievable. Everyone was rebelling against those old looks, the Marie Antoinette look, the stiff corset, all the bows, all the high hair, foot high hair, the great big skirts so wide you had to turn to pass through the door. All of that, they wanted to throw it off and be something new after the revolution. And there was also a big fashion for prison chic. Prison chic was very fashionable, and prison chic was essentially dressing like a prisoner, because the prisoners used to just wear their night dresses for the execution block, and they cut their hair short to be ready for the execution block. So people would go around in their night dresses with short hair, and they wear a red ribbon round their necks to show they're about to be chopped. And men would put their coats over their heads so they had no head. Well, prison chic was the thing, execution chic, and along with this, throwing off the old dark, you know, thick silk looks. And so Teresa, what she did was she wore these like unbelievable outfits, prison chic, but taken so far. So kind of see-through tiny baby doll nightdresses. And she would often bet people that her jewellery weighed more than her dress. And if they refused to assent, she'd just whip off her dress and have them all weighed in front of everyone. And she wore these kind of see-through gowns. And she used to have this thing about getting oil and tipping the oil all over herself to make the gown stick closer to her curves. So she was a real glamour sex pot. I mean, had there been the red top newspapers that we have now, every picture on the front would have been of Teresa and one of her outfits. And let's face it, also Paris was freezing, so she was a brave girl trotting around in a see-through chemise stuck to her with oil. And Josephine and another few ladies as well, they said, okay, we're going to dress the same, we're going to do the same. And Josephine and Theresia and Juliette Camier became known as the three beautiful graces. They're so glamorous. They wear these see-through gowns. They're always at parties. And everyone wrote about them. And, you know, by now, Josephine is no spring chicken by their standards. She is well into her 30s by now. Yeah. And Theresia is much younger. But by hanging around with these younger girls, everyone thinks she's younger as well. And this is also a brilliant way of her finding absolutely top-notch men. No longer the aristocrats, it's the politicians, it's the bankers. These are the men with the money.
You can rely on Radio Gorgeous. Tell us about her first meeting with Napoleon.
Well, her first meeting with Napoleon was set up by her lover, this banker, Paul Barras, who was a politician. He essentially ruled the country. He was incredibly rich, and he saw Josephine dancing about in her, you know, see-through dress with, you know, stuck to her bosom and all the rest of it, and said, that's the girl I want. And he took her on as a lover. And she was organised parties for him. She organised dances for him, and they often disintegrated into orgies. Let's face it. You know, you go to one of his parties and she'd come and sit on his lap, and Teresa would come and put her breast in your glass of champagne. So it was racy stuff. Carpe diem, carpe diem. Yeah. They're essentially saying, you know, we're alive. Yeah. Let's hold on to the fact we're
like
still alive.
1920s after the first world war.
This is it. Yeah. You know, what's the point of those old moral structures? Because we're still here, thank God.
Yeah.
And Barras Well, he was a very clever man. He was also very clever about seeing the potential of untapped potential of people. And one of those was Napoleon. Napoleon was an army general, a Corsican guy who was young. He was seen as rough. Everyone laughed at him. They laughed at him at military academy because he was really not aristocratic. He was a joke from this silly, silly place like Corsica. So Paul really spotted his amazing talent as a strategist and a general. So he said, I'm going to try and get this man on side because I want more power and I think I need the military's help. So he said, Josephine, could you do me a favour? Could you kind of flirt a bit with this Napoleon guy and get him on side, you know, flatter him a bit, you know, a bit of oiled bosom in his face. That'll be perfect. Josephine said, okay, I'll do that. And Napoleon knew all about Josephine. He'd been this lonely guy, laughed at by women, excluded by women. No one thought anything of him. He used to go around Paris going, look at these glamorous women. He wrote to his brother saying, women have all the power they want in Paris. It's amazing. And they won't look at me.
Well, he did stare, didn't he? And he was awkward.
Oh, he stared. Force. Yes, yes. Napoleon's idea of seduction was just to have a big stare at someone until they gave in. Oh. So that was Napoleon's idea of seduction. Yeah. So I don't know if it worked for George Clooney, but it worked for him. So he basically would stare at any woman, and most of them ran a mile going, this is a crazy, crazy man. Yeah. But Josephine, okay, Paul, Arash said, I'm going to sit next to you, and I'm going to sit next to him, and I'll flirt with him, and, you know, do a bit of fluttering of those eyelashes, put more rouge on, big blobs. This is one night in 1795. The candles were glimmering, the chandeliers sparkling. Napoleon sat by Josephine and she was using all of her techniques, all of the techniques of flirtation and flattery and innuendo, everything she'd learned over her tough time as a kept woman. And by the end of evening, Napoleon was completely obsessed by her. It didn't matter that she was his patron's mistress. It didn't matter that she was older. It didn't matter, he was engaged to a girl back home. He wanted her. He wanted her. Josephine was the one. He was determined to have her, and he would do anything to get her. She'd used her guns, and she'd fired on him.
So literally, this was the first person that he was ever fell in love with, wasn't it?
Napoleon wasn't a very innocent man. Mm. He had a fiancé, but he hadn't really comprehended what sexual romantic infatuation was. And truly, truly, this was in love, in big capital letters, flashing big pink letters over his head. She is the one.
How did she feel about it?
Well, Josephine initially was rather flattered, going, oh, well, you know, because every man fancied her. I mean, you know, every man fancied her. That was what she expected. I mean, if you sat by Josephine at dinner and you went away not fancying her, she'd be rather piqued. Yeah. So that was nothing to her, but it was a lot to Napoleon. And he kept pressing Paul Barras, going, please let her, please let her. And Paul Barras said, okay, you know, let's take her out, go for dinner and talk, because he wanted the friendship to grow, to keep Josephine and Napoleon close. Paul Barras had no idea what monster he was creating by encouraging Napoleon and Josephine to be friends. And Napoleon and Josephine, you know, they hung around more, and Napoleon just had this unbelievably passionate way of courting Josephine, which was something she'd never experienced, because every man she'd had been so jaded, such a roué.
It's all about etiquette. It's probably formulaic, whereas this man was animal, wasn't he?
He was an animal. He was pure, like, I want you. I'm going to have you. I want you. I'm going to have you. Stare. Over and over. That's what he wanted. And he was determined to get her. Josephine was actually increasingly won over by his energy, by his passion, by the fact he wasn't, you know, playing it cool, take it or leave it, the kind of guy she was used to. So actually she began to be rather interested in him. And soon Paul Barras said, maybe those two are getting it together. But okay, I'll let that go because, you know, Josephine actually was a rather expensive mistress to keep. She needed a lot of nice house, a lot of horses, interior decoration, a lot of clothes. So okay, Napoleon, you can take her over. Because Paul Barras was very like that. He was a very casual, roué, jaded man, and you know,
he'd seen him come and go.
You know, been there, done that. Nothing was new for him, unlike Napoleon, who was like, I'm in love with you, I want you now. So Josephine became Napoleon's lover.
So when did they actually get married?
Well, Josephine became Napoleon's lover very quickly after he did this incredible coup and put himself in power along with Barras. So
like someone even more attractive.
Even more attractive, power as well. Yeah. And there were these incredible letter that he wrote to her just after they've spent the night together for the first time, just after he's finally done the deed he's been craving. And he says to her, you know, I woke filled with thoughts of you. The idea of you gave my thoughts no rest. I was completely obsessed by you. And he says, I send you 1,000 kisses, but send me none back because they set my soul on fire. So, hot stuff.
Yeah.
And once he had her, he didn't just want her as a lover. He wasn't like all the rest. Mm. All the rest just wanted her in bed.
Yeah.
He wanted more. He wanted her as a wife. And Josephine, well, she needed a husband. Women need a husband. And certainly he was an option. Her friends begged her not to marry him because he was so poor. Her solicitor said, no. The lawyer goes, no, Josephine, don't marry him. He's got no money. Everyone said, don't do it. But she really thought, well, I'm heading into my 30s, last chance saloon. You know, my flower is going to fade. Okay, I'll get married.
Her instincts were so right.
Her instincts were right. And, you know, she also, you know, she could see his passion. She could see his determination. He was very powerful. He said to her, you know, babe, we can do a lot together, you and me, babe. And I'm going to be in control. I'm going to be the emperor of the whole of France. And she was like, oh, no, you won't. But still, she knew he was going to go. He was a man going places.
But also, I do want you to tell the story just quickly about how she went to a fortune teller when she was younger.
Oh, yes. When Napoleon, when Josephine was young in Martinique, there was a lot of witchcraft, a lot of fortune teller. And she and her cousins went to a fortune teller in the hills in Martinique. And one of them, the fortune teller said, would be a plantation wife. The other one, she said, would have a very exciting life and go to Turkey and be kidnapped, which did happen. The other one, Josephine, she said, you will be Queen of France, but your crown will not make you happy. And Josephine often thought about that. And even when she was in prison, when someone said to her, okay, one of the women said to her, okay, Josephine, your husband's been executed. You're next for the chop. Start praying. Just start praying. And she said, no, I don't need to, because I'm going to be Queen of France. And I'm not yet. And they were like, no, Josephine, yeah, really understand. Real. You get real. Yeah, start praying. Yeah, we all thought we were going to be the queen. Just get praying. And she escaped. And now when Napoleon was saying, hey, babe, I'm going to be a powerful guy. Just stick with me. We'll go places. She thought, maybe he will. And she married him. So they got married. And they were going to have a quiet marriage because he was a revolutionary hero. He couldn't have all the fancy stuff of an aristocratic marriage. So they went off to the town hall. She went there dressed in her simple dress, waiting for him with her witnesses. Paul Barras was a witness. She waited for him. And she waited. And she waited a bit longer. And then the registrar went to bed.
Oh.
He was so tired. And finally, Napoleon bounded up the steps hours and hours late. He said, I'm sorry. I was so sorry. I was completely caught up in thinking about conquering Italy. Well,
that's a sex tonic, isn't it?
That's a sex tonic. They married very quickly, but Josephine was a little bit piqued with him. She was a little bit cross, but she made sure he made it up to her because basically he knocked a few years up with his age. And knocked a few years down with her age to make them both 29. So the marriage certificate was completely wrong because it had the wrong ages on.
Yeah.
But who cares?
Yeah.
She was forever 29.
Now, what's interesting is that she didn't... She loved him, I think, in the way that her ego was plumped up by him and everything. But she was actually having an affair with Hippolyte?
Not quite yet.
Yeah.
She did love him, but I think, honestly, I think that she'd been desperate to love at 15, but the man then hadn't returned her love, and over in that, she'd seen herself being used, so she thought, I'm going to use men back. And by the time she met Napoleon, a man who was full of genuine passion for her, she couldn't really feel anything back in the same way. She couldn't trust herself to fall in love with him, because she thought, you know, she'd seen men who just got rid of women as soon as they weren't pretty anymore.
Yeah.
And perhaps that, and I think that was also what attracted Napoleon to her, the fact she was so calm, the fact she was so experienced. He loved her. He was sexually obsessed by her. She was calm and cool. He also he loved the fact she was an ex-aristocrat. He knew that would win the people over.
Yes.
And Josephine wrote a letter to a friend saying, he's so in love with me, I'm actually afraid of it. Because I think he's so desperately passionately in love with me that when he's not in love with me, he's going to hate me. She gave in, she married him, but she was nervous because she thought she'd never experienced this rush of feeling. and it was impossible for her to love him back. So not long after the marriage, Napoleon was packed off to Italy to go and conquer it by the government. And yes, that's when she started her affair.
With Hippolyte.
Hippolyte Charles, a man who everyone said was just a hairdresser. He was a soldier. But you know what? He was witty.
Yes.
And what
he was the absolute opposite.
He was opposite. He was witty. Yeah. He was fun. He wasn't determined. He wasn't passionate. He wasn't particularly clever.
Yeah.
He was beautiful. And you know what? Also, he was dazzled by Josephine, because Napoleon was dazzled by Josephine, but also he was such a massive power, he took up all the space in the room.
Hippolyte was like a gay best friend.
And he flattered her, said, "You're so marvellous, you're so great."
And I love the sound of him and his powder blue kind of livery. I must say, I would fancy him. I quite like kind of thick, pretty boys.
He belongs in a boy band. Perhaps not singing the main vocals, the backing vocals.
Yeah.
You know, her friends found him fun. It wasn't like they were like, "Oh God, it's Napoleon. He's just like he's so insane," because he was so passionate. This man was fun. But why did Josephine have an affair with him? Mm. So unwise. She suddenly is elevated into the general's wife. Everyone's watching her. She has all the money she could want because Napoleon's so successful. She's in with the politics. She's got a big, important social circle, and she starts having this affair. I think it is. Essentially, she fancied him. He was dazzled by her. Napoleon was away, and she still just a little bit like playing with fire.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing about Josephine. I didn't like her in the book yet, I must say, because I thought, she's just married a man and now she's having an affair. You know, this is so disloyal.
But I know, we are supposed to not have affairs when you're just married. And we're supposed to leave that, aren't
exactly.
we?
Exactly.
Like 5 to 5 years down the line, is that more?
Yeah, 5 or 7.
But then
it all turned round, didn't it? Because the power changed. Can you tell us how it changed?
Well, Napoleon had heard about her in Italy. He was desperate for Josephine to join him. He'd heard that there were some dodgy parties going on. He wrote to her. He begged her. She wouldn't come. He begged her again. She wouldn't come. Finally, he said, "You come to me or I'm coming back." I came back and the government was like, "Oh my God, we're going to lose everything. Come on, Napoleon. Okay, Josephine, into the carriage and off you go." And so she went off to see him in Italy, escorted by Hippolyte. He was her escort. So they took a long time getting there. And then they were in Italy and she played the perfect wife and Hippolyte kind of hid away. And then at Christmas, Napoleon rushed back quickly because he'd conquered Italy and was full of his conquering joy. And Josephine came back a bit slowly. She came back very slowly with Hippolyte and they were stopping at every pub on the way.
When they
got back, Napoleon was pretty cross. People said, "Why was she so slow?" And he said, "Oh, you know my Josephine, she is always never on time. You know a lady, she is always late." Ha ha ha. And then he set off to Egypt, determined to conquer Egypt. So he said, "Okay, I've conquered Italy. That's boring. I'm going to Egypt. Let's conquer Egypt." While he was in Egypt, one of his particularly, you know those kind of friends you've got? He said, I thought you'd like to know. I just thought I'd tell you this. I knew you'd like to know. That those type of friends. You're like,
no, don't tell me.
Yeah. I don't want to know. Yeah. He said, "Napoleon, you know, it's weighing on my heart. Josephine's unfaithful." Napoleon was horrified. He was devastated. He wept. He wrote letters to Josephine saying, "Oh, you know, it's over." Unfortunately, his letters in which he wept over Josephine's infidelity were intercepted by the enemy British and printed in the Times, and everyone laughed at them.
God.
But when Napoleon came back, he was furious. And Josephine went to meet him, but, you know, days before mobile phones, they missed each other. And he arrived back in Paris and she wasn't there and he was angry. When she came back too, he packed up all her dresses and put them outside by the watchman and said, "That's it. Bye-bye. You're on your ear." And she begged him and pleaded, dashed past the night watchman, dashed past the servants, fought her way into the house and begged him to take her back. And normally all she had to do when he was upset was just cry, because nothing more Napoleon liked than a woman on her knees crying tear-streaked rouge. And that's what she did. She said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Napoleon, it's not true." It didn't work. Finally, she begged him for the sake of her children. And Napoleon was very fond of Josephine's children. Essentially, they were like a ready-made family for him, these two stepchildren, the very responsible boy, the very engaging girl. And they're very, very, very lovely children.
Yeah, they sound
There's one thing that throughout history, lots of scholars about Napoleon disagree on something. We all agree that Josephine's children were really nice people.
Yeah.
She said to Napoleon, don't desert them. And Napoleon, of course, thought, actually, that's not fair, because Hortense, the girl, was about to make her debut. The boy was doing well in the army. So he thought, maybe that's not fair. And also, his own pragmatism came into play. Because essentially, Napoleon had come back from Egypt and he wanted more power. But like today, we expect our politicians to be happily married men and women. Especially, yes, indeed, indeed. We don't, we as soon as we see a marital scandal, we think it stops them governing the country correctly. So, and we like them to be, have the family, the family portrait. And so that's what he got with Josephine and her children, the family portrait. So all of his politicians said to him, don't divorce her, don't divorce her. Just put it under the carpet, ignore it and divorce her later when you've got the power because you need to look like a perfect, happy, married man. So he said to himself, okay, I feel sorry for her. I do still love her. I do still want to sleep with her. And it's going to be good for my career. So I'll forgive her. And there was no one who was more annoyed by this than his family, who all hated Josephine.
Yes,
they thought
were
she
horrible.
Oh, they couldn't bear her. They thought she was a spendthrift, a fashion plate. They hated her. They refused to come to the wedding. And they were, when they thought that Napoleon was about to get divorced, they were like, hooray! They were awful. And they were desperate for Napoleon's power. So essentially, they were really, really happy going, hooray! And then his brother called round next morning, all set to say, okay, Napoleon, let's get the divorce under the way. I'll find you another girl. And there was Napoleon in bed with Josephine as if nothing had happened. But he'd forgiven her. He had. But what had gone was the trust he'd had in her, the obsession he'd had with her. He was no longer convinced that his whole world was Josephine. He was now much more, well, you know, she's my wife, much more practical about her. He still loved her, but it wasn't the in-love way that he had, and he wasn't going to trust her again.
And it swapped over because she then became much more dependent on him, and he was the one that was more, as you say, laissez-faire.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Suddenly, she becomes the perfect wife, always cosseting him, always looking for what he wants, looking after him, soothing his brow, and no more Hippolyte. That was the end of the affairs.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
Now tell me about her massive extravagance, because she had a passion for life and she lived it in every area, as I said earlier. She had this house, ma maison, which she had animals, she had art, she had flowers. Can you describe it?
Josephine bought ma maison just while Napoleon was in Egypt. And she turned it into this amazing place for the pair of them. Fabulous gardens, a fabulous house. It was a pretty average kind of house. And she decorated it all. It was all about Napoleon. All the walls were full of his pictures of his victories. It was Greek stuff. It was Egyptian stuff. It was Italian stuff. And the gardens were her true pièce de résistance. She had plants from all over the world. When Napoleon sent an expedition off to Australia, she demanded everything came back, so they brought back plants for her. They brought back two of every animal and fed them on wine and bread all the way home from Australia. So most of them died. Most of them died, apart from some black swans. They lived and they became Josephine's prize black swans.
Wonderful.
in the garden. But I think the koala and the wombat died on the way over.
It's the wine.
Yeah, the wine, the drunken wombat, died happy. So they created this fabulous gardens filled with these wonderful greenhouses. They don't exist anymore. The house fell into disrepair and it's been renovated, but it's not like it was. And she had a menagerie. She had a flock of merino sheep from the King of Spain, some special cows. She had a Swiss goatherd to look after her, cowherd to look after her cows. It was all marvellous. And a real special thing was a little orangutan who used to wear a nightdress and eat turnips at the table. And this is where Napoleon entertained. Weekend after weekend, they all went there. And so he entertained there and he also plotted to get more power and he plotted to move himself up to be emperor. And once he was moving himself up to be emperor, pushing himself up to create that kind of power, he had power, he had money, and he wanted her to show the power. So he said to her, darling, spend, you know, like Pretty Woman, where they said, go out and spend, you know. Yeah. And he wanted to do this to
and
be
entertain, yeah.
He wanted, yeah. Yes, to be, to display his wealth.
Yeah. And so it really worked because she had the skills that he didn't have. He wasn't charming, he wasn't diplomatic. She would have amusing people. People were fascinated by her house and her lifestyle, you know. I mean, it really was an incredible. Also, what I found really interesting about the bringing the flowers and herbs and things over. She planted things in Europe that had never been grown before.
Yes. She planted these many flowers that never been grown before her.
Yeah. Napoleon and Josephine became, you know, it all worked. The plan worked. They became emperor and empress. Can you describe the coronation?
Napoleon and Josephine became emperor and empress, and her role had been to create this power for him by winning over the aristocracy, by winning over the royal family, the leftover bits of them, by winning over the royalists. And that's what she did. And then she created this fabulous home for him, Malmaison. And he said to her, well, I'm not sure. Maybe I should divorce you. Because maybe I should have an heir. Because emperors need an heir and they hadn't had a child. This was the big problem. She'd given him everything. She created this home for him. She wore dresses to please him. She wore these amazing gowns, spent huge amounts of money. She wore this amazing gown that had covered in rose petals that you couldn't sit down in. Another gown or toucan feathers, each of them tipped with a diamond. She had more ladies in waiting than Marie Antoinette. More jewels than our queen has ever seen in her life, which is a lot. She had everything. What she couldn't give to him was a child, and that's what he knew the people wanted. They wanted a child for two reasons, because really one reason why Napoleon got so much popularity was because he promised stability, was because the average person in France, the average businessman, the average housewife, they were sick of the political panic, the who was going to be killed next, or were you going to die tomorrow, weren't you? They wanted stability to get on with their lives. And this is what Napoleon promised them. He said, it'll be stable. I'll be in charge and that's it. You'll all be safe. And having an heir means you've got a continuity. And he didn't have one. Josephine didn't have his child.
She lied about having periods.
She lied. She went to all these quack doctors. She claimed she had these periods. She called it Little Red Sea. She claimed she had it. She claimed she didn't. She went to all these spas. Essentially, I think her reproductive system had been wrecked by her time in prison. I think it was pretty much completely decimated. Because, yes, she was in her 30s, but lots of women in those days did have babies, as they do now, late into their 30s and 40s. And somehow she had two already, so she could conceive, but somehow it just didn't work.
Maybe she had some sort of disease or, you know, something had knotted up or clogged or something.
I think so. I think so. I think she did have some kind of pelvic inflammatory disease or something, something that Napoleon never caught. So Napoleon said, maybe I should divorce you and marry someone else and, you know, have a baby. I don't really know. So it was all very difficult because he made all these plans for the coronation, and there was in the palace where she lived with him, there were these dolls. They put, well, maybe you'll put the Duchess here, maybe put the ambassador there, and that prince can go there. And so they worked out where all these prince people and princes were going. But there was no spot for her. She was this little doll and was put just outside of Notre Dame. Finally, at the last minute, Napoleon said, okay, I can't, I've got to be with her. I can't leave her, because he thought she was his lucky talisman for victories. Wow. And he said also, Napoleon was a very loyal man. He said, she paid attention to me. She looked after me. She believed in me when no one else did, when they all laughed at me. Mm. So I owe her this. I owe her this. She was with me from the bottom, so she's going to be empress with me. And all his advisors were like, no, 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 because they wanted him to remarry, especially a rich overseas princess.
Yeah.
But he said, going to be crowned together and that's it. But she had one special trick up her sleeve, and that was because they'd been married in a civil marriage, much easier to dissolve than a religious one. And the Pope arrived to crown Napoleon, and she said to him very quietly, you know what? Pope, we're not married. And that to the Pope was unbelievable, because he classed her as not married since she wasn't married in a church. He was just like, that's it. And the poor Pope had rather an undignified time in France. He was rather weary. And he says, right, that's it. Last straw. I am not going to crown two people living in sin. No, absolutely no. And so at the last minute before the coronation, Josephine and Napoleon were married by one of the Pope's staff. Napoleon wasn't very pleased. Josephine had won her victory, and she's given the marriage certificate and she puts it right in her bosom. Napoleon's not getting his hands on that one. There then is the coronation, and Napoleon is supposed to be being crowned by the Pope. At the last minute, he nicks the crown off the Pope, puts it on his own head. He says, I'm going to do it myself. And then he crowns Josephine in front of everyone. And everyone's just like, Josephine, Napoleon, what's going on? You're crowning yourselves, you nutters.
Yeah.
But Napoleon was power hungry, and that was just the beginning of him. It was a symbol of what he was going to be like, which was so hungry for power, so desperate for power, so wildly obsessive about just growing France. And Josephine was his backup act, his vital backup act. Number one, you needed a woman of great personality and determination not to be overwhelmed by him.
Yeah.
And also, she did everything for him that he couldn't. Napoleon wanted a big, rich court of everyone sitting there, you know, listening to him, just like in Versailles. He wanted that whole trapping. But the idea of sitting through six-hour court banquets drove him wild because he wanted to eat. He basically kind of...
He ate very quickly.
Yes, he was...
Chicken and potatoes.
Yes, he wouldn't take two bottles into the shower. He just shoved two things... He shoved his food in, ran off, you know. He was always like this. He was always doing something. He was always in a rush. He was always running around. He was like a bundle of nervous energy. He used to have like boiling hot baths. They were so hot that the secretary who was in taking dictation, because Napoleon wouldn't waste a minute, couldn't see through the steam. Every seat in the palace was full of these little holes because he used to stab it with his penknife when he was bored. He was this crazy fidgeter, all like that, talking really fast, doing things really fast. And so the last thing he wanted was court etiquette, you know, 6 hours meals, endless, who you sit down, you stand up.
Yeah.
And Josephine did all that for him. She ran this court for him. She created this fabulous look for him of the imperial furniture, the ladies-in-waiting, the dress, the diamonds, the jewels. And
so she had style.
She had style. She had the style he needed. Mm. She also gave the graciousness he didn't have because he was really rude.
Yeah.
I mean, Napoleon is a nightmare to have at a dinner party. He's the kind of person who...
Wouldn't sit and listen.
Yeah. And also he'd just go, this is horrible, I'm not eating this, and throw it on the floor. I mean, you know, he's the... Think of the rudest friend you've got and multiply it by 100.
I'm probably not friends with him.
I'm sure you haven't got a single rude friend, but think of a... rude friend and multiply them by 100.
The person I know like that is ultra rich and very powerful.
Interesting. Yes, Napoleon would be the kind of person to go, that dress is horrible, I've seen it before. He hated women without makeup. And Josephine smoothed it over. She was kind. She was generous.
She was very kind.
Very kind. I mean, she'd suffered a lot, so she had a lot of sympathy for people that she met.
Yeah.
She smoothed over the problem. She was the ultimate diplomatic wife. I mean, when you're a monarch, I think people often say rude things to you because they don't mean to, because they are so nervous and they want to say something important. They just they go, ooh.
Yeah.
So she was always so kind. So she gave Napoleon everything he didn't have, and she also kept on side all the posh people, all the aristocrats, all the pro-royals, because they saw her as one of them. And the fact she'd been in prison, that was prison chic, because Napoleon hadn't been in prison, of course.
Because
he wasn't posh enough. And so everyone saw her as really someone who'd suffered properly.
Yes.
And so she was a propaganda weapon to him. She was perfect for him. He was having affairs by now, but only with what we call, you know, popses, kind of court girls, actresses, you know.
Yeah.
Josephine hated it, but they were no threat to her.
And they were kind of one-night standish.
They were one-night standish.
In fact, he didn't sleep a night with them, did he?
Well, it was very unromantic, because there was one actress who complained that basically Napoleon had asked her to come to his rooms, and she went to his rooms and was expecting, you know, a bit of wining and dining, and then she heard a shout from next door where he was scribbling, tell her to wait. And she said, okay, I'll wait. He said, tell her to get undressed. And she went, okay, I'll get undressed. Tell her to get into bed. So, you know, ready and waiting. And he said, tell her I'm too busy. So it wasn't very romantic.
He had it off and then left them.
He was having his cake and eating it. It was about power. It was about mistresses.
I imagine a lot of politicians are like that now, and people, you know what I mean? It's like if you had an affair with someone that was very powerful, it would be all, because they are so... busy.
I'm too busy. I've got the UN on the phone.
Exactly.
Yeah, just hurry up and get it done.
So it'd be like quickies.
It'd be quickies. Sorry, everyone. You know, I'm really busy. Straight into the wardrobe. So Napoleon there was no threat to her, and she was the perfect wife for him. Perfect empress, very popular. People loved her when they didn't love him, and he knew that. He said that, you know, they like her more than me. But the one problem, she hadn't got a child, and he needed an heir for stability, and also because everyone hated his family. Everyone thought his family were completely awful, and they knew that the minute he died,
they'd grab everything.
His brother might take over. And a man like Napoleon, he's much more likely to die than, say, our monarch, because he's always out on battle, so he could die any minute.
Yeah.
And increasingly, everyone was saying to him,
whispering in his ear,
baby. And Josephine was offered all kinds of solutions, including... pretending to have a child, get pregnant by someone else, or that they just, you know, give her a fake baby bump, and then a baby will be smuggled in. And she said no, because of course that would be
how
a terrible
old was
act.
She by then?
Well, she's pushing well into her 40s by now.
Yeah, yeah.
So theoretically, it was still possible, but
and so with a very, very, very sad heart, he had to divorce her.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
Well, eventually he accepted it wasn't going to happen and he would have to divorce her. He was going to have to get rid of her. And Napoleon's divorce was, I mean, many divorces are, they're very long, drawn out affairs. But this one, he kept going, I'm going to divorce, to his ministers, he'd say, I'm going to divorce her. And they go, okay, that's good. Okay, well, let's start drawing up some list of princesses. Russia, Austria. And then you go, no, I can't, I love her too much. I love her too much. And he kept doing the same to Josephine. One minute he'd be really cold with her and she'd think she was for the chop. And next minute he'd go, I love you, I can't leave you behind.
I think she was a mother figure as well. I think she was emotionally everything. They opened up with each other. He said, we're a bourgeois couple, we sleep in the same bed.
We sleep in the same bed.
Which apparently nobody did then. No, I mean, they were genuinely a partnership.
They slept in the same bed.
And he'd open up to her, he'd cry in front of her.
He'd cry in front of her. She was the only person who was allowed to call him Bonaparte. The women of the time, you would call your husband by their surname. Josephine had this incredible intimacy with him. Mm. He loved spending time with her. Mm. He would come down and tell her his secrets. He would mess around with her makeup. And she was the only person who could calm him, because you can imagine, this is this crazy man who lives 55 miles an hour, and he relied utterly on her.
So very sadly, they did divorce, but then one amazing thing happened the day after divorce.
Just after they divorced, he came to Malmaison, where she was, and he said, I still love you, I still want to be with you. They walked around together, and he was really perhaps one of those people who leave their spouse or leave their other half and think things can continue more or less as they are. And they couldn't.
No, the ministers said,
the ministers said, stop it, it's looking bad, and you are never going to find a princess if you carry on with your ex. So he had to stop it. And you know, the night before they were divorced, properly, was the only night in which Josephine had failed to win him sexually. She went to see him in his chamber, ready for bed, and he said to her, he kissed her on the cheek and said, I'll always be your friend. It was over. And he set off and found another princess. He found an Austrian princess, a very young girl who'd been bred by her father to hate the French, but he said, okay, actually, I've changed my mind. Don't hate them anymore. Marry them. That was the end of Josephine's position when this girl fell pregnant, Marie-Louise fell pregnant with a child. With a son, Josephine was, she sent Napoleon a pin, a diamond pin, thrilled for him, but she was really pushed out of influence. Unfortunately for Napoleon, the minute he got rid of Josephine, the people were horrified. They did love her. They didn't want an Austrian princess. It was shades of Marie Antoinette, who of course was also an Austrian princess. They didn't want her there, and they hated the idea. And where was their beautiful, loved Josephine, the wonderful empress? So they still kept going to see her and kept talking about her, and the newspapers kept talking about her, and Napoleon was really, really annoyed. And he'd always said she was his talisman. And as soon as really she left, he started to fail. He'd overexpanded France, and he was, his idea about invading Russia in 1812 was insane. And once he started to overexpand, once he started to take on Russia, he was in a downhill spiral. And by 1814, he was essentially about to fail, about to be conquered. But Josephine was devastated when she heard in 1814 he'd been imprisoned and shipped off to Elba on the outskirts of Italy, the island on the outskirts of Italy. She was completely heartbroken. The Allies came into France, Prussia and Britain and Russia, and they treated her like Cleopatra was treated in the Roman times. She was this trophy, and they all wanted to go around and see her and have dinner with her and play with the orangutan and look at the black swans. And the Tsar was always there. She was the showpiece. They were like, we've got Josephine. And it was too much for her. She became iller and iller, and she caught a terrible cold when she was out walking with the Tsar. And then the night before she was supposed to host a huge ball for the Tsar, she fell terribly ill, awfully ill, and she had a chill. Really turned into awful pneumonia, we might say, in a sense. They said it then. This was a broken heart. She saw no reason to go on without Napoleon.
And what were her last words?
Her last words were Napoleon, with wearing her rubies in case anyone came to call. And Napoleon was devastated to hear this. absolutely devastated. And later he came back to France, he escaped and looked for her, wandered around Malmaison thinking of her, but then was imprisoned again, was sent off to Santa Helena. And when he finally died many years later in 1821, his last words were, "France, the army, the head of the army, and Josephine, he never forgot her."
Kate, it has been an absolute journey being with you on Radio Gorgeous today. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you've enjoyed
it. I've been thrilled to be here. Thank you.
So lovely. Thanks for coming on.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling? Des cieux qui font baisser le mien, un rire qui s'éperd sur sa bouche. Voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur, une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est le oui par moi. Je sens sans moi mon cœur qui...